Welcome again to Division 7 of the Court of Appeals. I think we're ready to hear the case of Foster versus CSU Equine Reproduction Lab, case number 213-CA-280. I'll remind everyone to turn off cell phones, pagers, or any other device that might disrupt the arguments. Also, I'll remind counsel to identify yourself and your registration number when you come to the podium. And with that, I believe we're ready to hear arguments.
May it please the court. My name is Dart Winkler, attorney registration number 33916, and I represent the state of Colorado as a special assistant attorney general hired by appellant Colorado State University and its equine reproduction laboratory. CSU has asked this panel to decide whether the nature of plaintiff's bailment claim lies in tort or could lie in tort for the purposes of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. Plaintiff's claim meets that definition for three reasons. The nature of bailment is in tort. Plaintiff has admitted that she could have asserted negligence, and the economic loss rule has no application here. We can tell the nature of bailment lies in tort from the Colorado jury instructions, case law across the country, including Colorado, general legal publications, and plaintiff's own admissions. The Colorado Supreme Court placed the jury instruction on bailment, which incorporates negligence, in Chapter 16 of the instructions, in the middle of instructions that deal with torts. The contract instruction doesn't appear until Chapter 30, and that's not required to be given in a bailment action. Between Chapter 16 and Chapter 30, the Colorado Supreme Court placed other classic torts, such as trespass and assault and battery. The Supreme Court also inserted a space saver for expansion of the instructions before it dealt with contracts. CSU identified dozens of states that have already determined that bailment can be asserted as a tort. Plaintiff did nothing to refute any of that case law or to contradict how bailment is generally treated across the country. How most states treat bailment demonstrates the nature of that claim. AMJUR, CJS, and the Restatement of Torts all summarize bailment as a claim that could be brought in tort, explaining that plaintiffs can choose whether to assert an action in contract or in tort. Because plaintiff can also assert a tort, the CGIA bars her bailment claim.
Counsel, what about, say, the Berg case, where the court held that certain claims, tort claims, were barred, but that contract-type claims were not barred, so allowed those to go forward? So it seems to me that if you can do both or either, yes, we'll dismiss a tort claim if it's asserted, but doesn't the contract claim go forward? It did in Berg, and that's a Supreme Court case.
That's not what it should apply under the CGIA, Your Honor. The CGIA bars claims that lie in tort or could lie in tort.
The Berg is a CGIA case. That's the problem.
Well, and if we distinguished this case between Berg, Berg had a set of a written contracts that the court was able to look at to determine what that contract duty was. The duty in bailment is imported from common law negligence to use reasonable care under the circumstances, and that comes directly from tort.
Counsel, would this case be different then if the plaintiff, Ms. Foster here, had actually had a written contract with CSU? Wouldn't it still be a bailment, but in that case, just simply based on an actual written document?
No, it still would not apply because the nature of bailment lies in tort, and it applies regardless of whether there is a written contract or an agreement at all. As stated in Christensen v. Hoover, constructive bailments where there's no agreement between the parties still have the same negligence, common law negligence standard of care imputed into them, and that's without any agreement at all.
But if we had a contract, let's say we have a contract here that's been alleged, an oral contract, that you will store this property, and in return, I will pay you a monthly fee. What if there were a dispute over the payment of the monthly fee? Would you still be saying that because it relates to bailment, it'd be a tort claim?
Under the CJIA analysis, which looks at the nature of the claim under bailment, which is imputed from common law negligence, we think that it encompasses that definition of could lie in tort, and therefore, yes, it would be precluded under the CGIA.
But the problem with that is all these authorities you cite to, many of them make clear this distinction between claims that are based upon the contractual relationship or contractual duties and those that are based on tort duties. They're all bailment cases. And you can have a contract for bailment, which is alleged here, and you can have a contract claim for breach of that contract, such as a failure to pay. And well, these other authorities recognize that, the ones you cited.
Sure. The contract here had only two terms that the district court recognized. Well, that was for payment and for storage. So CSU's only obligation under that contract was to provide storage for these straws. Now, what plaintiff has alleged in her complaint is that she's trying to hold CSU responsible for failing to act reasonably to keep her property safe. That goes outside the subject of the contract. The contract terms related to the storage of these straws. What she's done in her complaint is referenced this valuable breeding mare from which we know she's attempting to get damages based on the offspring. Those offspring are outside the scope of the contract, which is involved only the straws. So the contract damages, as CSU pointed out in its briefings, would be limited to the value of those straws, whereas the tort damages might very well include subjects outside the scope of the contract, such as those the offspring from those valuable breeding mare that she referenced in her complaint.
But her complaint only seeks contract damages. She just talks about damages under the contract and consequential, which is a damage type of relief.
As CSU pointed out in its briefings, there's the time at which you measure contract damages is based on what's foreseeable at the time you enter into that contract. That was in 2009. She purchased this valuable breeding mare in 2010. The tort damages would be measured in 2011, around the time when she says CSU failed to reasonably protect her straws. In 2011, tort damages, perhaps CSU could have known about this valuable breeding mare with which she intended to breed those straws. However, in 2009, when the contract was created, there could not have been any such knowledge, since it's based on facts that happened after entering into that contract.
Mr. Winkler, I guess I'm a little confused about why it matters, whether it's these supposed to be contract damages or tort damages. I thought your position was because it could have been a tort claim, the CJI bar or grants immunity, regardless of whether her particular claims come within contract or tort.
Well, that's true. The case law is clear, however, that damages and the remedy sought is a way to determine whether a claim could be brought in tort. And therefore, it just demonstrates that she's seeking these tort damages, the future offspring, that could not have been foreseeable at the time she entered into the contract. And therefore, it indicates that those are the damages she's seeking under the tort remedies, not under her contract remedies.
Thank you.
Looking at the nature of bailment explains why she had the choice to bring the negligence claim. Colorado, as you know, like other states, imposes that presumption of negligence in the bailment relationship. Because the one with possession of the property is necessarily in the better position to determine what happened to the property, how it was damaged or how it was lost. Plaintiff misses the mark by trying to focus on whether she would ultimately prevail. But that's not what the CGIA requires. At any stage in the bailment action, the question for the jury is whether there was negligence in storing the property. And the burden of proof never shifts from plaintiff, who will need to demonstrate CSU was negligent in order to succeed.
Counsel, do you concede that, as the trial court seems to have concluded, that this matter was proper for disposition without a Trinity hearing?
I don't think either of the parties disputed that regardless of how you come down on the factual matter, there's a legal determination that needs to be made about whether the nature of bailment lies in tort or could lie in tort. Accordingly, let's say there is an issue that goes to whether it lies in tort or could lie in tort. It doesn't matter what the answer to that question is. It could lie in tort.
Mr. Winkler, could I ask you a question about the economic loss rule?
Certainly.
If this tort claim were barred by the economic loss rule, would we still say that the claim could lie in tort?
The economic loss rule has no bearing on what the nature of the claim is. The economic loss rule is designed to apply only when the parties to a contract fully contemplated and negotiated their obligations and exposures to liability. And the purpose is to keep contract and tort separate. That has nothing to do with whether the nature of the claim lies in tort or could lie in tort.
Counsel, I don't think I agree with you on that. The purpose of the economic loss rule, when it's applied, we don't say your tort claim fails. We say you don't have a tort claim because you have a contract claim. We don't say you could assert the contract claim, but it just happens to lose. We say you just don't have a tort claim. So getting back to Judge Navarro's question, isn't application of the economic loss rule here mean there is not a tort claim? Not just that there is an unsuccessful tort claim, but that there isn't one at all.
The economic loss doctrine does nothing to test what the nature of the claim is and whether it could be brought in tort, which is the focus of the CGIA.
Well, if you just take a typical economic loss case, I don't know if you've read some of those, maybe like Hayman Contractors or something. So you have a contract between the parties, and then one of the parties claims that there's a misrepresentation relating to performance of the contract. For instance, in that case, we didn't say, well, that tort claim, it's a tort claim, but it fails because of XYZ. We said there was no tort claim to be asserted because of the economic loss rule. And here, they would say, there is no tort claim to be asserted because of the economic loss rule. I'm not getting the distinction you're trying to draw.
I think perhaps I can explain it this way, Your Honor. The economic loss rule focuses on distinguishing between contract and tort remedies. And bailment, the nature of bailment, is actually a convergence of those same principles. So it's not a good fit to use the economic loss doctrine in a bailment case from the get-go. Pushing beyond that, it's typically applied when the parties have fully negotiated and contemplated all of the terms of the contract. As the trial court determined, the only two terms we're dealing that are in this oral contract are payment and storage. Importantly, missing from there are damages. And as the case law CSU pointed out in its briefing indicates, that is integral to the economic loss rule and should not be ignored, and the economic loss rule has no application here. I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
You may.
May it please the court. Gordon Hatfield, number 42759, on behalf of the appellee, Heather Foster. Before we proceed, I would like to briefly apologize to the court for my delay, as well as to Mr. Winkler and his parties due to weather. It's not how I wanted to start out today. Let me jump right to it, though. Everyone, I think, is in agreement here as to what the issue is. That is whether or not Ms. Foster's claim for oral contract for bailment is barred under the CGIA because it could sound in tort. Now, Ms. Foster puts forth four separate arguments asserting that her claim is not barred. First, her claim for breach of oral contract for bailment is necessarily contractual. Although, as Judge Fox pointed out earlier, there was no formal Trinity hearing at the trial court, there was a hearing in which the trial court determined that it was undisputed that there was an oral contract. Second, Ms. Foster's claim is contractual and not barred by the CGIA because of the existing precedent of Spahr v. Greeley. The Colorado Supreme Court has already addressed this. Mr. Winkler has correctly pointed out that the Spahr case preceded the passage of the CGIA, but I'll go through the reasons of why it's still good binding law. Third, the economic loss rule does foreclose any tort claim that could be brought by Ms. Foster. And finally, fourth, as has already been pointed out by Judge Jones, even though Ms. Foster may have additional tort claims, if they weren't barred by the economic loss rule, it doesn't mean that her contract claims are also barred. So let me jump into the first aspect of this, which is the contractual nature of a claim for bailment. As I've already stated, the trial court determined that there was an undisputed oral contract. As you can hear from Mr. Winkler and see from the briefs that have been submitted, CSU tries to draw a distinction between the oral and the written contract. I think it's a distinction that's not appropriate to apply in this case. As the court knows from Christensen and other case law, a bailment claim must contain an implied or express contract. Must.
Well, actually, Christensen didn't. The Christensen court said expressly there was no contract, but that a bailment could be implied constructively by law. So, and I think the other cases out there, all the other legal authorities are very clear. You don't have to have a contract.
I understand, Your Honor. I guess our position, though, is that the court will then imply this contractual relationship, but it's a contractual, an implied or constructive contract between the parties. And this is because once the property has been deposited, the other party is going to have a duty to protect it or store it as agreed upon or as expected in this constructive contract. I want to point out here, though, this is not a case, a gratuitous bailment case, where Ms. Foster has left her property with CSU. It's in fact a bailment for mutual benefit. Ms. Foster, as was alleged and discussed during the trial court hearing, was billed quarterly for monthly fees, which she paid. So there is this agreement. We do have a dispute as to the exact terms of the contract. I think as the trial court did correctly note, at this time, all that's been decided is that there's an agreement related to payment and storage.
Counsel, my concern is that it seems to me the trial court did exactly what the CGIA says it should not do. I mean, the CGIA says that, you know, when you have a claim for an injury that lies in tort or could lie in tort, you don't look at the type of action or the form of release chosen by the claimant. And the district court's order, to me, reeks of looking exactly at what the plaintiff pled and the damages that she was seeking, which is not what it's supposed to do. So how can we affirm the trial court when it goes directly against the CGIA's directive?
Your Honor, I don't, and I want to take a step back. As the court knows, and as Mr. Winkler has pointed out, it's clear that no amount of artful pleading can transform a tort claim into a contract claim. But I think in this case, the reverse is also true. No amount of artful briefing by Mr. Winkler can transform a contract claim into a tort claim. So in this case, the contract was alleged. Yes, it was an oral contract, but it's still a contract claim. I don't think and if you could explain a little more what you mean by the district court's misapplication of the CGIA, I could perhaps answer you more effectively.
Well, the focus of its analysis was on, you know, what damages were being sought here, and, you know, obviously the plaintiff pled contract type damages, but you're not supposed to that's not dispositive of whether something lies in tort or could lie in tort. Instead, as the CDOT versus Brown Group retail case tells us, you're supposed to look at the nature of the duty from the breach giving rise to liability. And so it's the nature of that duty. Isn't it based, in fact, on the relationship between the parties?
Your Honor, I do think the trial court did address that, however briefly, in its analysis under the economic loss rule, when it analyzed what is the, where does this duty come from? Is it one that's been implied by law, or did it result from an agreement between the parties after their bargaining? And in this case, there is no general duty for CSU to store reproductive material for the general public. This duty only arises after the parties have entered into an agreement. In this case, yes, it was oral. In other cases, as has been noted by CSU, there were written contracts. These are agreements that were bargained for, in which Mrs. Foster provided consideration and received storage. Also, I don't wanna belie that there is some complexity to this disagreement. You can't just store this horse semen anywhere. It has to be in controlled vats. There are only a few places across the country that can, in fact, store it. So we would say there was a contract between the two parties. It's not even a constructive bailment in this case. It's an express oral contract. I'd like to move on briefly.
Well, counsel, I've got a couple questions to follow up on this last point. Where the duty comes from. Now, you say here we have a contract. That's true, okay? But as previously pointed out, you don't have to have a contract to have a bailment, and you don't have to have a contract for this duty to exist, because the Colorado case law, including Christensen, says once the relationship is established, the duty is implied by law. It doesn't say the duty comes from the party's agreement. It says the law implies the duty. So given that that's the standard, why isn't that a tort claim? I mean, that's how we distinguish. Where does duty come from? Does it arise from the promises, or does it arise by virtue of law? And the case law here, including Christensen, says it arises by operation of law.
And Your Honor, just to, I'm thinking about the ramifications of an application in which we would have a contractual agreement like Ms. Foster's bailment claim, where a portion of the elements are clearly contractual, such as the amount paid and the nature of the storage. And then we'd also have a separate section of this contract, which is a tort and which is not covered.
But we have a lot of examples of that in the law. We have insurance contracts, contractual issues, but there's this breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, which in that context is a tort claim. We have these cases dealing with residential contracts to, say, fix plumbing. Okay, the Kulik case, the Metropolitan Gas case, you have contracts, and yet there's this obligation implied by law that's independent. So that's not unprecedented.
Correct, Your Honor, but I guess when I look at this, the obligation implied by law, and also the presumption of negligence that has been addressed in the briefing, this only arises after the creation of the contract. And for that reason, I think it sort of puts the cart before the horse. You must have the contract prior to having these implied duties.
But the case law says you don't. I mean, Christensen says you don't. It expressly says that. You don't have to have a contract. A bailment can be implied. It can be imposed constructively. And in fact, that was a negligence case. They prevailed on a theory of negligence without a contract. That's a Supreme Court case.
I understood, Your Honor. If you don't mind, let me address SPAR then, which I think is directly on point to this case. As the court likely remembers in SPAR v. Greeley, there's an airplane owner who arrives at the Greeley Airport. The Greeley Airport provides tie-down stakes. There's wind, and the owner's property is damaged. Now, in the SPAR case, the Colorado Supreme Court determined that the bailment claim was not barred by governmental immunity. And if you, admittedly, the SPAR decision, it's short. It doesn't provide us with a lot of facts. But what we do know is that there's no written contract between the parties. I've gone through that case numerous times. There doesn't even appear to be an oral agreement for bailment in that case.
Well, it was pled as a contract claim.
Exactly, Your Honor. But in that case, the Colorado Supreme Court determined that the bailment claim was not barred by the CGIA. Now, Mr. Winkler's pointed out that SPAR is decided in 1957. The CGIA comes along in 1971. So we should essentially throw SPAR out. Now, looking at the history, though, of the formation of the CGIA, so as the court is aware, we have the Evans trilogy of cases, which essentially abrogate governmental immunity. When the CGIA is passed then in 1971, the goal is to reaffirm the immunity that existed before the abrogation of the Evans trilogy. So all we seek from SPAR, and I think what's still good law from SPAR, is that one, a bailment claim is contractual for purposes of the CGIA. This is still true. A contract claim is not barred by the CGIA. This is still true today, of course. The citations in Barr, to example, to ACE Flying Services, is for exactly this theory, that contracts are not barred by governmental immunity. It's still true. If we extend this to the bailment prong, we can see that bailment claims are also not barred. So for this reason, I understand this is a complex issue. Bailment is a blurry claim, but it's been decided by the Colorado Supreme Court, and we think that SPAR allows for the court to affirm the district court's finding. Now, I'd like to briefly address the economic loss rule in this case. And this really goes back to discussions we were previously having related to the source of the duty. Now, CSU's main argument in relation to the economic loss rule is that it should only apply to cases in which there's been a fair bargaining between the parties to allocate risk accordingly. In this case, CSU provided the services to Ms. Foster. They had a chance to negotiate with her. They clearly had a rate that they charged. They clearly had standards which they had to store the material. This was set. At this time, we haven't gone into fact discovery, clearly, but I think these remaining terms will become flushed out through discovery. So I think we're sort of artificially limited to what we know of the terms of the contract at this time. Finally, I'd like to close with just what was brought up earlier by Judge Jones, and this is that if Ms. Foster has a negligence claim, and interestingly, which the trial court determined that she did not, she still can bring her claims in contract. The Byrd decision is the one we've cited to. I think it's the one that's most directly on point. As the court remembers, in that case, the contract claims were allowed to proceed. If I recall, it's a claim against a CSU for disability-related insurance.
Well, counsel, that's an important point to me. But it seems to me in Byrd, the contract claims existed independently of the tort claims. But here, you know, bailment is this funny thing. You know, it appears in the case law that a bailment claim, and I'm going to be specific, one for destruction of property or loss of property, can be pled in the alternative. That is, you complete it as a contract claim, you complete it as a negligence claim. Some jurisdictions say you complete it as a conversion claim, but it's alternative. It's not you can plead two different claims or three different claims. You get to plead one claim, you kind of get to pick your theory, sounds like. So that seems to be a little different than Byrd. And then we have Robinson, which is much more recent, says where you can plead a contract claim as a tort claim in the alternative, it's barred. So don't we have to deal with Robinson?
I understand, Your Honor, but I don't.
You can answer.
There is no alternative claim that could be alleged here, precisely because the economic loss rule is going to foreclose any tort claims. They simply don't exist. And for that reason, I think that's what distinguishes the bailment claim from Robinson and Berg, is that there simply is no tort claim to be pled.
Okay, okay, I understand your argument there, and I realize we're out of time, but I want to follow up. In a lot of these other jurisdictions, we have the economic loss rule, and yet in bailment, they still say you can plead in the alternative. How can that be reconciled?
And, Your Honor, just to specifically address that, you know, I've gone through the numerous, I think, 31 state research that Mr. Winkler exhaustively performed. And that's a larger issue than I think we have to solve today and in this case, which is the bailment claim affected by the CGIA? So I think that that scope is an interesting question. I wish I could give you a more eloquent answer. But I think that the question is so broad, it just simply does not need to be decided by this court this time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hatfield. Mr. Winkler, you have approximately 2 minutes for rebuttal if you'd like it. Although if you need a few extra minutes or so, we might give it to you.
Appreciate it. Plaintiff asserts that the SPAR decision by the Colorado Supreme Court applies to her claim, even though that even though the standard for governmental immunity differed back in the 1960s when that decision was rendered. Courts no longer determine governmental immunity based on whether the action involved governmental power or proprietary power. The CGIA changed that analysis entirely, as we've been discussing. The analysis now is, does the claim lie in tort or could lie in tort? Additionally, the Bankers Warehouse case, which was decided prior to SPAR, established that in the bailment situation, the plaintiff has established a prima facie case of negligence. That's the language that the Supreme Court used to describe bailment in that circumstance. Mr. Hatfield referenced discovery about the terms of the contract, which is confusing because we have already established through the trial court that everyone was in agreement that there was no need for a Trinity hearing to establish these disputed facts that could affect or impact whether the CGIA applied. None of it has to do with whether bailment lies in tort or could lie in tort. Honorable Jones, I'd like to answer your question about reconciling the economic loss rule with bailment, and it's because the nature of bailment lies in tort. That's the distinguishing factor here. You've got all of the case law supports that. It's the duty is implied from common law negligence into this bailment relationship, and that's exactly why you can have this seemingly inapplicable situation. Otherwise, as I think you've grasped onto, the economic loss rule would necessarily prevent anyone from ever bringing a negligence claim, especially in situations where you do have a written contract that was fully negotiated, fully contemplated, and agreed to with all of the individual terms specified. See, I'm out of time, and I appreciate your patience and attention today.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Winkler. Thank you to both counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.